Welcome to another episode of Digital Exploration, where today we rewind the tape to the bright and inventive 80s, a decade that not only danced to the rhythm of synthesizers and arcade blips, but also pioneered the very tools that would allow gamers and creators to compose their own electronic symphonies of play. In the vibrant glow of arcade cabinets and the quiet focus of early personal computers, a revolution was brewing, not just in how we played games, but also in how they were made. It was during this neon-lit era that the gaming world saw the rise of game creation systems, simple but powerful, innovative software that handed the keys of game design over to the players themselves. From the beginnings with the arcade machine and the pinball construction set, to the melodious possibilities of the music construction set, the mysterious adventure construction set, the racing destruction set, and more, these tools democratized game development, making it accessible to anyone with a computer and a spark of creativity. Each of these early game creation systems opened doors to uncharted territories of imagination, inviting everyone to not just partake in video games, but to also create them. So as we delve into the stories of these pioneering tools, let's celebrate the spirit of innovation and creativity that defined the 1980s. Stick with us as we uncover how the decade of arcades and action gave rise to the era of creation, right here on today's trip down memory card lane. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. I hope these words find you well. Hello and welcome to the 193rd episode of our video game history podcast, A Trip Down Memory Card Lane. Each week, we'll tell you a story relevant to the current week in gaming history. It can be about a game, or the people that created it. It can be about a console, or the technology that brought it to life. We often talk about the companies that bring it all together, making our hobby, video games, a reality. While teaching you each story, we hope to teach you, well, while telling you each story, rather, we hope to teach you something new about the topic, what it took from the world as its inspiration, or what it gave back to the world and its legacy. Today, we are diving into the fascinating world of early game creation engines, focusing on software from the 80s, the pioneers of do-it-yourself and indie game making. These pieces of software represent the earliest examples of game programmers opening the doors for all creative types to create video games, regardless of their programming skills. I'm David Kasson, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, who, if I'm being honest, I really just created by throwing together a bunch of options in the co-host construction kit. He's my brother, Rob Kasson. Rob, what traits do you think I put together to get you?
Well, Dave, it's obvious that you had to pick one with humor, good looks, and a little bit of OCD.
I probably did select all that, yeah.
Yeah, makes sense.
Those seem like they're good traits for a co-host.
Damn straight it does, Dave.
And it makes you one of a kind, super unique.
You got that right. Only one. Or so you think.
That's scary. Don't do that. Multiple ones of you is frightening.
Well, Dave, I don't know.
I don't know either. Good try, though. So what do we got for this week in gaming history?
Well, Dave, on May 5th, 1980, Sierra Online released Monster... Mystery House.
Monster House is cool too, though.
It was a good movie.
Yeah.
Sierra Online released Mystery House, the first graphical adventure game for the Apple II. Now over four decades since its debut, Mystery House introduced players to a novel way of interacting with games through visual elements paired with text-based storytelling. The game not only pioneered the graphical adventure genre, but also established Sierra as a key player in the development of adventure games. The release of Mystery House was a seminal moment in gaming history, catalyzing the evolution of visual storytelling in video games and paving the way for the success of future graphical adventures.
We did a whole episode on it. We did a whole episode on the history of Sierra Online, and Mystery House was definitely part of it. So go check that episode out in our archives.
Yeah, go check it out.
Go check it out.
It was May 5th, 1992, the gaming world was revolutionized with the release of Wolfenstein 3D by id Software. Hailed as the grandfather of 3D shooters, it introduced players to a first-person perspective and fast-paced action, setting the standard for future titles in the genre. The game follows the story of BJ Blazkowicz, an Allied spy, as he attempts to escape from the Nazi stronghold Castle Wolfenstein. This breakthrough in game design featured textured 3D environments and enemy AI that was innovative for its time, offering a new level of immersion and interactivity. Wolfenstein 3D's success not only popularized the first-person shooter genre, but also paved the way for subsequent classics such as Doom and Quake, establishing a legacy that continues to influence game developers today.
What do you know? We did an episode on that too! That was 88. I know, right? Ooh. Crazy that we have these, like, very important games in history that we've done entire episodes on. That's such a novel concept.
Let's go check them out.
Go check them out.
On May 7, 2003, the French video game company Infogrames officially rebranded itself as Atari, a name synonymous with the video game revolution of the 70s and 80s. This strategic move was aimed at leveraging Atari's iconic brand appeal following Infogrames' acquisition of Atari Corporation's assets in 2001. By adopting the Atari name, the company sought to capitalize on the nostalgia and recognition associated with the historic brand, known for pioneering hits like Pong and Asteroids. This rebranding marked a significant shift in the video game industry, as Infogrames transitioned to focus on a broader and more globally recognized identity under the Atari banner, attempting to rekindle the spirit and innovation of its namesake.
What do you know? We did a history of Infogrames in episode 91. Crazy.
It's so weird. It's like we're talking about a lot of stuff in This Week in Gaming History.
I know. Just nuts.
On May 10th, 1996, Zelda's Adventures was released for the Philips CD-i, marking the third and final Zelda title for this platform. Now 28 years since its debut, Zelda's Adventure is noted for its departure from the series' traditional top-down perspective, instead presenting a live-action visual style with full-motion video. Unlike its predecessors, the game featured Zelda as the main protagonist, embarking on a quest to rescue Link. Despite its innovative use of CD technology, Zelda's Adventure received mixed reviews for its gameplay and technical performance. However, it remains a curious piece of Zelda franchise history, reflecting the era's experimental approach to game design and multimedia.
Which is a nice way of saying nobody liked it.
It's a very nice way, but you know, if you want to learn more about it, we may have talked about it.
We may have talked about it a little bit, but I definitely owe it an episode.
Well, its own episode. But, you know, there's a little history on the whole Zelda franchise, in which we talk about the Philips CD-i and how terrifying it is.
We also talk about the CD-i itself when we did the Hotel Mario episode.
Right you are, Dave. On May 7, 2001, Presto Studios released Myst 3 Exile, the third installment in the critically acclaimed Myst series, originally developed by Cyan Worlds. Now 23 years after its debut, Myst 3 Exile continues to be celebrated for its rich, immersive worlds and complex puzzles. Set within an expansive and beautifully rendered environment, the game introduced players to a new antagonistic and deeper story element that significantly expanded the lore of the Myst universe. The release of Myst 3 Exile marked a pivotal moment in venture gaming, praised for its artistic design and innovative use of 360-degree panoramic navigation, pushing the boundaries of visual and interactive storytelling in video games.
That it did.
Indeed. You know, we talked about the origin of Myst.
We did.
Hmm. Let's go check. Yeah.
That was a really good episode, actually.
Yeah, it was my introduction to what Myst is, because before that,
I don't know. Also, your introduction to Apple HyperCard, which is what Myst is.
Very true. So if you want to learn more about what the HyperCard is and learn like I did, a lot of learning in this one. A
lot of learning. That's what we do around here.
Indeed it is. For our last option, our last topic today in A Week in Gaming History, Dave, May 6, 2003, CCP Games released EVE Online, a massively multiplayer online role-playing game, MMORPG, that set a new standard for player-driven economies and persistent universe mechanics. Now celebrating its 21st anniversary, EVE Online offers a vast galaxy where players engage in exploration, combat, mining, and complex economic trading within a universe that evolves based on collective player actions. Known for its steep learning curve and expansive scale, EVE Online's launch marked significant development in the MMORPG genre, influencing the design and community engagement strategies of future online games.
We talked about EVE somewhere. We've never done an episode on it, but we've talked about EVE, and I don't remember where, and it's bugging me. I always ask you, but I know you don't remember where either.
It wasn't an EVE episode?
No, we did not do an EVE episode. It was somewhere related to MMORPGs. I know that much. I just don't remember exactly where. Because there was some fascinating stuff in EVE. There's a lot of fascinating stuff in EVE, actually.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I know we definitely have talked about it, but I guess someone will have to go listen to our health catalog to find out where.
It also probably deserves its own episode, so... Yeah, gotta add that to the list, huh? Gotta add that to the list. Lots of
games.
That
we do. Lots of games.
Today, with that being said, today we are not here to talk about video games, actually. I mean, we are.
What?
We are, but today's gonna be a little different, you know? So, we live in a fantastic time in which it's easier than ever to create your own video games. You know, two of the largest video game engines out there, which are Unreal and Unity, make tools to develop using their respective engines available. These tools are available to just about anyone at little to no cost. So if you're listening to me, you could literally go to Unreal or Unity's website and download the tool set that they use to make video games.
That's Unreal, Dave. But you know, the Unity that it creates,
oh my God,
is a great one for the gaming community.
It is. You are right. If you were unsure of how to even go about creating games using those tools, there is a wealth of knowledge at your fingertips thanks to the internet. Not only is there comprehensive documentation found within the game engines themselves, but you can go on YouTube or any number of websites. There's like Udemy for learning. There are so many websites that have tutorials that will teach you to use just about any facet of those game engines. And to be fair to the situation, the game engines themselves are easier to use than ever. Both of them have tools designed to let you create within them without needing to learn any programming whatsoever. These are kind of, not kind of, they're literally what we call visual scripting tools. There are, of course, other pieces of modern software that are not these juggernauts of the industry that have been doing the same thing. There's a game engine called GameMaker, for instance, that also has its own scripting language and visual scripting language. So you could program or script, if whichever you want to do. And aside from this, there are lots of other pieces of software that aim to let people create without needing to learn programming. Among these, off the top of my head, are Game Salad, ClickTeam, Construct, and Stencil. These are kind of like Game Engines Light. They're more consumer-targeted game engines. They have specialized tools and interfaces. They belong to a genre that we call game creation systems. Now, Rob, any of the things that I've mentioned so far, the Unity, the Unreals, the Stencils, the Game Salads, have you ever dabbled with any of these programs before?
I cannot say that I have, Dave, no.
No, so no game development in there in any way, shape, or form?
None for me.
None for you. Well, we both know I have. Aside from knowing a bit of Unreal and Unity, I actually got my start on Game Maker. That was one of the first ones I ever picked up. But I've also done ClickTeam, Construct, Stencil. I've never used Game Salad. But I've dabbled in all of them just to see what I like the most. So, I mean, Game Maker was my choice for a little while when I first got into making my own little projects as a hobby. And then I eventually moved on to Unity and Unreal. Now, before we get too much further into this discussion, I do want to note that all of these examples are what we call general purpose engines, right? There are game creation systems that are very specific to a genre, to a platform, or even to a specific game itself. So, for instance, Super Mario Maker is technically both a platform game and a game creation system. It has an easy-to-use specific set of tools designed to let you create your own Mario Maker levels. Now, I want to take a moment there, and I want to let you know that there is a difference between a level editor and a home game creation system, right? So a level editor just lets you create levels in an environment. That's all it does. Whereas a game creation system would let you expand a little bit outside of that by maybe modifying the way the level works or the way your character moves or the sound effects or things like that. It's got to be above just placing things in a room really to be a game creation system. Does that make sense?
I suppose it does.
Rob, we've talked about Roblox before, haven't we?
Have we?
I think we've talked about Roblox before. Have you used Roblox before?
I've not, Dave.
So Roblox is another game creation system. Little Big Planet, which we've talked about on our podcast before, also a game creation system. Little Big Planet is all about user-generated content. The PlayStation platform also has Dreams, which is yet another game creation system. Virtual reality platforms have what's called Rec Room, which fits the definition. And then there's also a very specific one called RPG Maker that's been around for a long, long time. It is very specific to RPGs, but also a game creation system. Now that we've expanded this definition, is there anything that you've tried that comes to mind that might fit the bill for a GCS?
Not that I have played, no.
No, so you've never dabbled any like games where you get to create things in its entirety?
No.
No, I know your favorite games are like the Arcs and stuff of the world, and that's a little different. I was wondering if maybe you had ever tripped out any of the more robust systems than just that before. So,
I mean, I do own Mario Maker and have played other people's levels. I guess technically, if you're looking at that, I have played it. I never myself got into the level design aspect of it, though.
Gotcha.
So, never have I done the side of the actual building.
But you're familiar with the environments, though.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. All right. There are many options for creative people who want to get into making content or the games themselves, without actually needing to do any programming whatsoever. But this is not a new concept by any stretch of the imagination. And I thought today that we could take a basically a moment and look at some of the early game creation systems from the 80s specifically. Now, these are very much the pioneers of do-it-yourself gaming, the pioneers of indie gaming, because a lot of they're like, we have an independent games festival. It has a category for games made on this. Games made on these game creation systems would typically fall under an indie gaming umbrella. So these were the tools that kind of allowed people to create indie games before indie games were even a thing, is a good way to look at it. One of the earliest ones I could find was made by Broderbund in 1982. It was called the Arcade Machine. The Arcade Machine was first published for the Atari 2. It was later ported over to the 8-bit computer line. It was basically a piece of software that allowed you to create alien attacks similar to what you found in Galaxian. You know, that top-down aliens coming down and across the screen shooting at you, you know, and you dodge their shots and shoot back at them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Its user manual states that if you ever wanted to design and program your own fast arcade game, but been stopped because you didn't have a programming background, then the Broderbund arcade machine was built for you. And what it had was a basic sprite editor that would let you design your own enemies, players. You could design your own explosions. You could draw the backgrounds behind them. Then you'd assign a path that your enemies would move to and fire to, pathing. And then you could also choose between some limited sound effects, mix them up a little bit, set the rules of the game too. And essentially what you could create using the arcade machine was this little 5-level game using these tools. And then you would be able to save it. This is what's so novel to me. It would let you save it onto a self-booting disk so that you could play your game without ever needing the software again. So you could essentially make a game, an arcade machine, copy it, you know, through the program to a self-loading disk, never admit that you made it in arcade machine, and sell it as your own software by just copying that boot disk over and over and over again, you know?
Interesting.
Interesting indeed. Well, I mean, this was the early 80s. They weren't thinking really yet about things like copyright and stuff like that. So from January 31st until June 30th, 1984, Broderbund actually ran an arcade machine contest where users could submit their own creations for a chance to win a grand prize of $1,500, which is roughly about $4,500 today, which is not too shabby.
Not even a little bit for doing something like that. Come on.
I mean, for someone to just pick up a piece of software like Little Big Planet Dreams or Mario Maker, and then Nintendo was like, yo, best Mario Maker level ever created, we'll give you $5,000. People would be all for that, you know?
Undoubtedly.
I mean, admittedly, it sounds basic, but for the time, it was pretty robust software. And people did use it to make games. I was actually able... There's a site called Atari Age, which is a great resource for anything Atari, if you ever want to learn anything Atari. There's actually a list of games made in the arcade machine that were published as standalone titles listed on the Atari Age website. About 20 different titles that are basically made using the arcade machine. You know, mixed in, of course, there are games that very much resemble Galaxian. But there's also some games that you'd never guess came out of the software because, again, there's some incredibly creative people out there that really take the time to learn how to utilize the tools they've been given, right? There was an underwater shooter called Aquamarina. there was some great artwork in a game called Patrol Nighthawk 1, which basically looks like a plane flying through a mountain range shooter. So, I mean, it had some beautiful mountains on each side that you were flying in between. That one looks spectacular. And then there was one that basically looked like an isometric shooter on city streets called Street Attack. They were all made using this arcade machine, but they look nothing alike. Like, nothing alike whatsoever. So, you know, people were giving creative people the tools to make games. I mean, 1982 is pretty early on in the video game industry, you know? So
that definitely is.
Now, the arcade machine was commonly compared to what is probably, and there's a little bit of confusion. I couldn't really find which came out first, but there's definitely a more popular piece of game creation software that was also released in 1982. Now, this one, admittedly, is pretty much credited with creating what we call the construction set genre of video games, which eventually became known as game creation systems. And that is the pinball construction set written by Bill Budge. Now, Budge is a very interesting character. He is one of those rare video game developers. I feel it's a rare trait, at least. He's a video game developer who does not enjoy playing video games at all.
What?
Seriously. Weird. He famously described the months in which he had to play pinball in order to develop the pinball construction set as sheer torture.
That'd be like, I feel like that's the same as Carroll Shelby admitting he doesn't like driving cars.
Right? You know, and that's come up before in interviews. Bill Budge does not like playing video games. He is a programmer. He enjoys programming. His first game was a Pong clone called Penny Arcade. He created his own graphics routine for it. And then he traded Penny Arcade to Apple for a printer. No joke.
Great trade right there.
I know, right? Well, this is the 80s when printers were a lot of money. So it was a Centronics printer. I don't know. That probably doesn't mean anything to most everyone, but
not a damn thing to me, Dave.
So writing the graphics routines, fast graphics routines, were what Budge really enjoyed doing. And if you look at reviews for his games, you will find that he is best known for consistently excellent graphics. So with that reputation, he decided that he wanted to start, you know, selling his projects and not just trading it to Apple. He worked for Apple, to be fair, just a side note. So he decided that he was going to partner. He found a partner. His partner was a floppy disk drive salesman. The kind that travels from store to store. So a traveling floppy disk drive salesman. And he agreed to split the profits of his games with the salesman 50-50. And so they developed a company called Budge Co. to peddle these games as the guy did his other job and sold floppy disk drives from store to store. Because that's the way they did it back then, right? The distributors would send a salesman, you know, on their distribution network from this computer store to this computer store to this computer store getting orders. If you've ever seen, what is it, Tommy Boy? They do that with auto parts, right?
Yeah, that they do.
That they do. So that's basically how it worked here. And so Budge got latched on to one of those traveling salesmen and said, sell my games 50-50. Budge was shocked when that salesman returned with his first check, which was $7,000 at the time. That's $21,000 now. That's not shabby for his first haul into this little game development. I mean, $20,000, no one would shy at that nowadays, you know?
Well, majority of us wouldn't.
Yeah. So needless to say, Budge kept at it. You know, he was working at Apple in 1981, and there was a pinball craze going on. So he thought it would be fun. He thought it would be a fun programming exercise to write a pinball game. So he did. He played pinball. He took a pinball machine apart to examine all of its pieces to make sure that he understood it properly and recreated it properly. And he made a pinball game called Raster Blaster. And then he followed it up, Raster Blaster, followed it by recreating some of the tools and adding more tools into what's now known as the pinball construction set. And the pinball construction set is exactly what it sounds like, right? You can build a virtual pinball table by dropping bumpers, flippers, and spinners, as well as some other parts, onto a virtual pinball table. And like the arcade machine, you can save your creations to a self-booting floppy disk. Now, up until this point, through Raster Blaster, Budge had been self-publishing as Budge Co. with his traveling salesman, you know, printing the discs and the manuals and putting it all in Ziploc bags and sending it with his Willy Wonka counterpart off, you know. But that was a lot of work. And Budge wanted to program, not do all the work. That wasn't his thing. Under Budge Co., the pinball construction set was just really just doing okay. But then Bill Budge was approached by none other than Electronic Arts founder Trip Hawkins. The two had met while they both worked at Apple. Trip Hawkins had moved on, but that's where he started. We did a whole episode on EA and Trip Hawkins. Go check it out. Trip wanted EA to publish the construction set. So Budge went, you know, and asked his friends, which includes Steve Wozniak. You know, that's part of the story. Gotta add that the Woz was part of it. So he conferred with everyone and then decided that getting distribution through EA was, you know, a smart thing to do. So EA is now in charge of distribution, and the pinball construction set with EA's clout behind it just frickin' takes off. It eventually sells 300,000 copies between all of its platforms, which eventually include all the Atari 8-bit computers, the Commodore 64, and eventually IBM-compatible PCs and early Macs. And like I said, it's pretty much credited with creating this game creation system genre. Steve Wozniak once called it the greatest program ever written for an 8-bit machine. And interestingly enough, you know, this is the 80s, right? We're still using BASIC and pretty much DOS, which is all word-based to control computers. We don't have anything resembling Windows, like a graphical interface at this point. But while Budge was working at Apple, he wasn't part of the project, but they were building, in the building, the Apple Lisa. The Apple Lisa was the first mass market computer that did have a graphical user interface. There was one before Windows came out. And like I said, he didn't work on the project, but it's pretty clear that he was very aware of it, because the user interface in the pinball construction set software is very Apple Lisa-like. So in the same breath in which Wozniak says, hey, this is the best software ever created for an 8-bit computer, he also mentions, like, this is probably, to thousands of users, also the first time that most of them ever experienced a graphical user interface of any kind. Which is a really fascinating thing if you think about it.
It really is.
I mean, we got our start somewhere, you know? Before we move on, I do want to note, you know, kind of talk a little bit about Bill Budge. He stayed around games and computers pretty much his whole career. You know, he was with EA, turned the pinball construction set into a Sega Genesis port called Virtual Pinball in 1993, left and went to work for 3DO for 9 years until that company shut down. He created a 3D engine for at least one of their games. He was a lead tools programmer for Sony for 6 years after that, and then he ended up joining Google in 2010. He retired from Google in 2022. So that man had a solid career working on the things he wanted to work on. He programmed the engines and tools for companies for his whole career, pretty much. So these two games are definitely where the genre started. But it certainly didn't end there. There are many other examples of construction kit software through the 80s. People were really eager to create their new their to people were really eager to create their own content. And speaking of new content, are you looking to start your own podcast but just don't know where to start? Do you sit down to look at all the tools available to you and you just get overwhelmed by all the choices? Well, stop. Bad. Don't do that. It's not all that difficult, because our friends at Zencastr have created for you an all-in-one podcasting suite of tools that make it easier than ever to create your own podcast.
With Zencastr, it's super easy to record a podcast. Everyone logs in using their web browser, and you just start recording a high-quality podcast right away. It allows you to record up to 4K video with your guests, and with Zencastr's multi-layered backups, you always have the highest quality recordings, even when your connection's unstable.
And with Zencastr, you never have to worry about what you sound like. Zencastr's post-production process always makes you sound amazing. It automatically removes all those ums and ahs, gets rid of awkward pauses in the conversation. There's options to set your desired podcast loudness, reduce background noise, cross-gating, and then you pick all the options, click a single button, and away it goes. When it's done, it'll send you an email that says, hey, your post-production's done, come download it. You go back and download it and do whatever you want with it.
And even if the thought of podcasting overwhelms you because you think you need tons of different tools and services, relax. Those days are over. With Zencastr's all-in-one podcasting platform, you can create your podcast, do all that fun little editing stuff, and distribute it to major destinations, all from one place.
So, if this sounds great, and you'd like to start your own podcast, or maybe it sounds like some tools that would allow you to take your current podcast to the next level, we've got a deal for you. Go to zencastr.com/pricing and use our offer code, all one word, memory card lane, and you can get 30% off the first month of any of Zencastr's paid plans.
Sign up for Zencastr today, and you can experience the same ease in producing your own high-quality podcast as we do each week. Go out and share your ideas with the world.
And there were plenty of people who did want to share their ideas with the world. So after the success of the pinball construction set, Electronic Arts continues to produce other construction kit games, hoping to capitalize on the success of the genre. All the rest of the games are different genres, they're written by different authors, but they all kind of share that name, Construction Kit. In 1983, they published the Music Construction Set, which was written by Will Harvey. And basically, this came about because he was creating other video games, and he needed a set of tools to create music for them. Now, the Construction Set allowed users to create musical compositions using a graphics interface. You could drag and drop notes right onto the staff. You could play the songs right through the computer speakers, and then you could print out your composition when you were finished. In fact, the Music Construction Set is likely the first ever commercial sheet music processor made for home computers, as it was originally released for the Apple II. It was eventually ported over to the Atari 8-bit line, the Commodore 64, and IBM-compatible computers. So, Rob, all that software you played with in music theory class, this is probably the great granddaddy of all of it, so.
Damn, that's pretty crazy.
In 1984, EA published the Adventure Construction Set, written by Stuart Smith. The Adventure Construction Set was designed to make tile-based graphical adventure games. Smith designed the game as a set of tools to create games like one of his earlier games, which was called Alibaba and the 40 Thieves, which was basically a tile-based dungeon crawler. So with this construction set, you could create your own world map with dungeons in it. You could set random encounters that were turn-based encounters. Combat could be ranged or melee. You could create your own spells. It had shops that you could sell items in. I mean, it was a pretty robust adventure set of tools. And like Broderbund, when EA came out with this Adventure Construction Set, they created a contest around their software, and they picked basically three different winners, and I'm not sure what they won. I'm assuming it was money, but that wasn't very clear in the info I found on it. So, and then in 1985, EA also published what's called the Racing Destruction Set. That sounds fun.
Yeah, it does. Early Burnout.
It let players design and race on tracks with a variety of vehicles, first for the Commodore 64. So you could create your own track for starters, right? There were different templates for straightaways and turns and different configurations. There were ramps. There were elevation changes in the layouts. So there was a lot of variety. There was different terrain. You could lay down icy sections of track, which would obviously you would have no grip on. You could change the gravity of the entire race to make it seem like you were, for instance, racing on the moon. Maybe you could race moon buggies, right?
Okay.
And now you might be wondering, why Racing Destruction, right? Right? Because,
well, I'm assuming there was destruction involved.
Yeah, there were two modes. There was a racing mode and a destruction mode. In racing mode, you would simply choose the number of laps and go at it. And in destruction mode, you also had access to oil slicks and landmines, which you could shoot out of the back of your car in order to destroy other cars. That one was more of a, you know, Twisted Metal type environment.
Hopefully you're out front, though.
Hopefully you're out front. The Racing Destruction Set was eventually ported over to Atari 8-bit computers. And even still, the legacy of the Racing Destruction Set extends beyond that. It was actually remade on the Super Nintendo Entertainment System in 1991. It's a game called RPM Racing. And RPM Racing ended up being successful enough to get its own sequel in 1993, which was called Rock and Roll Racing. So it's really interesting that this little game creation kit in 1985 kept trickling down to Rock and Roll Racing in 1993. It's a long legacy, right?
Indeed it is.
And legitimately, there are a few other games that jumped on this racing bandwagon, so to speak. In 1986, Activision published a similar game called Fast Tracks, the Computer Slot Car Construction Kit, which is pretty obvious what you're constructing in this one because it's focused around slot cars. And what's fascinating about this one is that it's written by Mark Turmel, who is also known for creating NBA Jam. He is a really prominent figure in Midway. So when you're talking about NBA Jam, Mortal Kombat, like a whole series of Midway things, Mark Turmel comes up. We actually talked about Turmel and Midway and NBA Jam back in episode 85. So if you're curious about Midway's history or NBA Jam, any of these, go check that episode out. And speaking of episodes to listen to, we also looked at the history of Adventure International in episode 155. Adventure International is a company that basically created the earliest adventure games for home computers. You know, there are earlier ones that were on mainframes that we've talked about, like Zork and Colossal Cave Adventure. But when home computers came out, it was Adventure International that jumped on it and made a whole, basically, series of games that were adventure games for the home computers. But they didn't just make these adventure games. They also took the time to publish other games, and among them was a game called Rally Speedway. And Rally Speedway also had an editor for creating your own racetracks, for changing the vehicle handling and the vehicle and other things to make things more interesting. Rally Speedway is actually said to be the direct inspiration for the NES game Micro Machines, which I freaking loved.
Was a fun game.
You liked Micro Machines too, huh?
Oh, yeah.
I really enjoyed the NES Micro Machines. Really, really enjoyed it. That was a fantastic game. That was a fantastic choice. Yeah. I remember these construction sets. We had, I want to say, the adventure and the pinball one, mixed in, like we had the Atari versions of them. There was also a monster construction kit that I didn't really talk about. I remember we had that one too. So we had these. These were like mixed into our early, you know, all the PC library in the 80s, basically. Like I remember these because I started writing BASIC on the Atari 8-bit computers. That was where I started. I don't remember playing with these. I don't know if I ever got some of them to work properly. And if I did, I have no memory of them other than I remember the disc being part of the collection at the very least. But I don't remember the programs in any way, shape, or form, if I'm being honest. I mean, these would have all been like, I would have been like 4 and 5, you know what I mean?
Right.
So this is a little early on for me.
And me.
And you've been pre-you. It's been very early on for you. Strategic simulations joined the fray. It wasn't just EA. Activision wasn't just like these bigger guys making this kind of stuff. Strategic Simulations, that does a lot of wargaming, actually made the wargame construction set in 1986. It's exactly what it sounds like. It allows users to basically construct, edit, and play wargame scenarios. You could draw maps and place geographical features, add buildings. There were units from different periods of history, so you could either create like modern warfare or medieval battles. There were fantasy elements if you wanted, so you could create sword and sorcery scenarios and sci-fi scenarios. They actually made 3 of these. The Wargame Construction Set 2 included armored combat, and then they made a Wargame Construction Set 3, which was called the Age of Rifles, 1846 to 1905. And that one was clearly a little bit more specific for the time period it was designed to focus on, you know? But yeah, you had these games that let you make war game scenarios and play through them. Speaking of war games, ASCII's War Game Construction Kit was a little older, came out in 1983. It allowed people to make text-based strategy games. Strategic Simulations was a little more graphical-based. So these were basically ASCII symbols. And you could make your own gameplay mechanics, make your own scenarios that would allow you to like design these intricate battlefields and different military simulations without really needing any fancy graphics. So all these people that were into strategy and tactical type stuff could use this game construction kit to make their own stuff. There was a game called Adventure Master released in 1984 that was more text-based, puzzle-based. It allowed people to create these intricate narratives and develop puzzles, create interactive environments, all through a very user-friendly interface to create, you know, adventure games. There was one in 1985 called Gary Kitchen's Game Maker. That's an earful, huh? Gary Kitchen. We love Gary Kitchen, don't we?
Sure, Dave.
We love Gary Kitchen. Absolutely. That came out in 1985. Game Maker software allowed you to create in a whole wide range of genres. There was platforming and shooting games. You didn't need to have programming experience. It was virtually script-based. It allowed you to basically create so many different things from the ground up without any prior programming knowledge. It had a sprite editor, a music composer, a level editor, had basically all the tools you need. People made some really creative things with the Game Maker software. They also made really creative things with a program called World Builder in 1986. That was designed for the Apple Macintosh, allowed you to create graphical adventure games. You could, again, it was more interactive world building, right? You could design and build your own interactive worlds. It was really well known for putting together graphics and text to develop these really rich narrative-driven environments that people were really engaged by. So you could create, essentially they were point-and-click text graphical and graphic adventure games. They were point-and-click adventure games. That's what they were. 1987 saw the Shoot 'em Up construction kit. It allowed enthusiasts to make their own sprite-based shooters. It originally came out for the Commodore 64. but was later ported to, you know, the Atari line, Amiga, things like that. You could design your own sprites and customize your own levels and script enemy behavior, you know, so you could do all these things without any programming knowledge. And there are actually some really decently known Amiga games that were created using the shoot 'em up construction kit, and they don't go together at all. So Monster Truck Rally, which is exactly what it sounds like, was made using the shoot 'em up construction kit. But so was The Wielder of Atoms, The Mulroney Blast, and Smurf Hunt. So, you know, those ones sound like shoot 'em up games, right?
Especially Smurf Hunt.
Right. But Monster Truck Rally, definitely a creative use of the shoot 'em up construction kit. Just saying.
Which is odd to think.
And then finally, we also have the arcade game construction kit. That was a Commodore 64 bit that came out in 1988. It let you create your own arcade-style games. By 1988, we had really robust software. That came with six different games, puzzle game, platform game, adventure game. Like, it was really robust. We kind of had all the tools by then. It was pretty advanced. It was pretty late in the game, though, because by then, people were starting to move on to other things, like Windows would soon be on the way and consoles would take over gaming and so on and so forth. So for the most part, most of these are kind of pieces of software that have fallen into obscurity. But for this brief period in the 80s, construction kits were a thing, you know? If you weren't a programmer, you could pick up one of these and probably spend a lot of time making something really interesting. And people did. And because of the way these softwares were designed, they were able to save their games to a disc. And some people actually sold games made with these systems as actual games, which is really fascinating if you ask me. Because, like, to me, that's like someone, I already said it, like, you know, making a Mario Maker level and selling it as their own, you know?
That is pretty crazy, and it also begs the question, how many people still have those floppy disks around with these games that they created, you know?
That's entirely a good point, like, and that's something that we talk about when we have discussions about game preservation in general, is how many of these old games are gone, or just laying there in a box that people don't know what they have. Heck, so I contribute to the Video Game History Foundation, and we have a Discord. And the other day, someone on Facebook posted a set of prototype chips from a Super Nintendo cartridge. We don't know what it is. The only word on it is Hellfire. And so we have an idea based on, like, SNES and Hellfire, what it is. But realistically, it could be anything on those EEPROM chips, right? Like, it needs to be dumped and scrubbed through. To find out what prototype these guys have. They actually don't know. They reached out to, like, a collector community, and somehow someone who's part of it got back to the Historical Foundation and was like, hey, I think you should see this because this might be something you guys are interested in, because game preservation is very much, like, that's one of the main tenets of the Video Game History Foundation, you know? And so that head of the foundation reached out, and I'm sure he's trying to figure out what it is and if it's something we can get our hands on, so they can get their hands on. I'm not going to pretend I'm part of that. I'm just there to talk to interesting people, really. So, which is what I do all the time. That's what we do, Rob. Talk to interesting. Well, you, I guess you're interesting.
I don't know if I should take that as a compliment or not, Dave.
But anyways, needless to say, these game creation systems have been around for a long, long time. And in the 80s, there were some really great representations of the type of software that we have today. The Mario Makers and the Dreams and the Game Makers and Clicker Teams and all that stuff has some really special granddaddies in the construction kits of the 80s, because that's what most of them were called, right? The construction kits. The pinball one made by the guy who doesn't like video games. The music one made by the guy who needed to make music for his video games. The adventure one made by the guy who just wanted to send out his tools that he used to make his other video games. I don't really have one of those anecdotes for the destruction racing kit. That one's
someone who liked destructive racing.
Yeah. So a lot of interesting things. But there's a lot of history here, right? These construction kits all tie into other things. You know, Bill Budge was, you know, part of Apple and got into, you know, it with the Apple Lisa and Wozniak. And in the beginning, we talked about, you know, the games that we had other episodes on, like Wolfenstein and so on and so forth. And I would really encourage you to go and check out all these other episodes. There's a lot of really great stories of video game history in our archives. And of course, you can do so by going to our website, www.memorycardlane.com. Rob, what else can people find on our website?
Well, Dave, people can find a calendar of our future episodes. Maybe give us a little insight into some fun, crazy knowledge you have about some of the topics that we are going to discuss. You can find a link to our Discord where you can just come hang out, talk whatever really with Dave and I, and maybe just tell Dave how he's wrong about a lot of things. Don't give him the satisfaction of being right like I unfortunately had to today. You can find a link to our Patreon where you can help support us and get access to ad-free and unedited versions of our episodes. And you can find also a link to our social medias, where I can be found on several platforms as Rob_O_Raptor and Dave.
I can be found on various platforms as David is wrong. Each week, we tell you a story about one topic relevant to the Crow Week in game history. It can be about a game, a console, technology. I just find a way to make the topic relevant to the current publication week to the best of my ability. I've slipped twice, three times in the past however many years. While doing so, we hope to teach you something new about the topic, what it took from the world as its inspiration, or what it gave back to the world in its legacy. One of the reasons why we keep doing this every week is because I have a thirst for knowledge, and when I sit down to research for these episodes, I learn things, and in turn, I get to take all the fun things that I learn and teach you, dear listeners, all this really cool stuff about video game history. So it's a really great cycle of learning and teaching that I really enjoy. And so we've been at it now for 193 episodes, and I don't really intend on stopping anytime soon because I like learning things. In celebration of that concept, that cycle of birth, we like to talk about what we've learned every week. So Rob, what did you learn today?
Well, Dave, honestly, I learned that there were a ton of different construction kits for these early computers and consoles. I really didn't know that that was a thing. And you even mentioned how, like, Super Mario Maker is one, and I hadn't really thought of that being one. I really just thought of it as a level creation and not really just the whole kit. And it's just kind of insane to know that these things were so prevalent, and kind of begs the question, how many people actually used these when they were young and got their interest in game development and actually used that to then lead into their future career developing games because they got to try out these sweet construction kits in the early days?
They sure did. I thought about that as I was doing this episode. I kind of am surprised that I haven't found that yet in any story. Like someone who's like, oh, I got my beginning on one of these construction kits. This knowledge was around at the time. You know, we talked about a lot of guys who would program through the magazines and copy from the magazines. And so there were different ways to it. But I'm honestly surprised I haven't seen more of that for sure. I will totally give you that, because I would like to find someone who got their start here. That's just the honest truth. So
yeah, definitely be interesting to know. So that's me, Dave. How about yourself?
I know of the pinball construction kit. It's not new to me. Like I said, I think we had it. I never paid attention to its origins before. So finding out that it was created by Budge, who does not like to play video games, was really interesting to me, because that's a really weird character trait for a game developer. You don't see that. I don't know if I've ever, 193 episodes in, I don't know if I've ever seen another like game developer interview where the developer was like, I don't like video games. Like, I don't, honestly, this might be the first one if I'm genuinely thinking about it. So that's my favorite part.
It is very interesting when you think about it, but you know, he enjoyed programming and it still gave him a chance to do so. And, you know, he didn't really care what program was being created. He just cared about getting to look at the code and do all the crazy behind the scenes stuff.
Well, and then he made a career out of making the tools, right? That's what he did for the rest of his career, was making the tools that other people use to make stuff, basically.
Yeah, so, you know, still a huge contribution to the gaming industry, even if gaming wasn't for him.
True statement. All right, Rob, well, before I take you to the next week, is there anything you'd like to add to today's episode?
As always, I want to take one quick moment to say thank you so much to all of our listeners. It means the world to us to have you along as we get to learn all these new and exciting things. Well, I guess old and exciting. But all of these exciting things about games that we have grown up to love. So thank you for joining us on our journey as we explore week in and week out.
Very true. Well, that, my friends, wraps up our Pixel Power journey through the groundbreaking world of 1980s early game creation kits. We've explored how tools like the arcade machine and the pinball construction kit opened the doors for gamers, not just to play, but also to create their own digital stories. It's a testament to the ingenuity and passion of that early gaming era, which has clearly paved the way for the indie game experience as we know it today. Next week, though, we are trading our digital toolkits for six shooters and saddles as we dive into the gritty world of Red Dead Redemption. We'll explore how this game was made, and not only made, but also how it revived the Western genre in video games, how it set a new standard for narrative depth, how it set a new standard for open world immersion. A whole lot to cover. So dust off your cowboy hats and get ready for an adventure through the untamed frontiers of the Wild Wild West on next week's trip down memory card lane. Do the thing.
Scooby-doo-m-bot-n-dot-n-bot-n-dot-n-bot-n-dot-n-bot-n-boo-ah-dah.